pro-Palestinian activists, including deporting non-U.S. citizens. New York Times investigative reporter KDJM Baker spoke to the people behind Project Esther for her new piece. The group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. Katie joins us now to explain. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. What did you find?
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, so I found that the architects behind Project Esther said that it's no coincidence that what we're seeing in terms of actions taken against universities and pro-Palestinian protesters on a federal, state, and local level has happening months after they released their report.
So the Forward had originally talked about this kind of white paper of the Heritage Foundation, but you went much further. You name names and talk to people behind Project Esther. Tell us who they are.
Yes, so the woman overseeing Project Esther is Victoria Coates. She is a former national security advisor to Trump during his first administration. And she has a long history of working on Israeli matters. And then Robert Greenway ran the Abraham Accords, and he's one of the co-authors of Project Esther.
And if you can talk about what exactly their plans are, and how many Jewish groups are involved in shaping Project Esther as they talk about, as the leaders of Project Esther talk about combating anti-Semitism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Project Esther aims to rebrand all critics of Israel and pro-Palestinian protesters as providing material support for terrorism. So that means that anyone who's ever participated in a pro-Palestinian protest at a university, for example, is potentially providing material support and should be fired or deported or otherwise ostracized from what they call open society. And there's not very many Jewish groups involved in this project. There are a few, but the task force that inspired Project Esther was primarily Christian and right-wing organizations.
Can you talk about the role of Christian Zionists?
Yeah, there are some Christian Zionists who are interested in Israel because they think that it will help bring about Christian dominion worldwide or bring about biblical end times. But there are also a lot of Christians who just see shared Judeo-Christian values and support Israel for that reason. And I think most interestingly, Heritage incorporated a lot of arguments about anti-Semitism into their attacks on higher education more generally after October 7th, and they blame DEI, Black Lives Matter, those types of progressive movements for what they see as the rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses.
I wanted to turn to someone you quote in the piece. Democracy Now! Spoke Sunday with Stephanie Fox, the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, to ask for her response to what you exposed about Project Esther.
You know, Project Esther was created by the ultra-conservative white Christian nationalists and should be understood as an addendum to Project 2025, which is the Heritage Foundation's plan to remake the U.S. in an ultra-conservative image. It has absolutely nothing to do with Jewish safety, and it is intended solely to destroy the Palestinian liberation movement using tools that can then be used against all communities and movements and democracy itself. We can see clearly that Project Esther sets out a path for the Trump administration to sharpen those legal regimes that will best advance MAGA goals. So, for example, the targeting of international students like Mahmoud Khalil for abduction and deportation because of their political views is a terrifying attempt to expand already unjust counterterrorism and immigration laws against Palestinian rights movement, immigrant communities, and civil liberties writ large. The Trump administration and groups like the Heritage Foundation think that if they target the groups they believe to be most vulnerable, so Palestinians, anybody who will defend Palestinian human rights, immigrants, trans people, then nobody will stand up and fight back. But this country's fascist turn is not inevitable. If a united coalition can beat back these attacks now, we can destroy the momentum of Trump's broader agenda. And we understand that what justifies that agenda is the same thing justifying U.S.-backed Israeli genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. We see the twin evils of the cynical use of false accusations of anti-Semitism that ensure the Israeli government can't be held accountable, and also the pervasive and constant racism and dehumanization against Palestinians. Those tactics are decades old, and frankly, they've had bipartisan support. The MAGA right is now consolidating and accelerating those. And so it's on us to remember that they rely on the weaponizing of anti-Semitism and the deploying of anti-Palestinian racism because they've lost the argument. The very notion, take for example, the Hamas support network, which is the term used by the Heritage Foundation to describe the Palestinian liberation movement, it's a contrived and baseless smear that is obviously intended to vilify any and all criticism of the Israeli government. And the accusations would be laughable. They're outlandish, they're baseless, if they weren't being translated into such deadly serious policy endangering people's lives right now. But there are millions of people, including the majority of Americans and a growing and massive number of Jews, who want to see a stop to the Israeli genocide of Palestinians, who are outraged at our tax dollars being used to murder and starve tens of thousands of children, and who want the U.S. and Israeli government held accountable for their crimes against humanity. And it's in the face of these repressive attacks that our only option is to be bolder, clearer, in defense of Palestinian life every single day, and to be demanding justice, equality, and freedom for all people, no exceptions.
That's Stephanie Fox, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace. One of the groups that Project Esther identifies, as she refers to it, as a Hamas support organization, HSO. Also, they refer to HSN's Hamas Support Network. If you can talk more about that label.
Yeah, so Project Esther focuses on anti-Zionist groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace, but they aim to go much more broader than that. So there's a whole network, according to them, that includes not just those groups, but large nonprofits like the Tides Foundation, George Soros as a mastermind on top of this pyramid that they showed in pitch decks to potential donors. Then, of course, there's colleges and universities that are harboring these organizations, members of Congress, senators, the media, really anybody, you know, like I said before, who has criticized Israel or participated in any sort of pro-Palestinian activity.
How has the Trump administration begun to fulfill some of the objectives outlined by the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther?
So I want to be clear that the Trump administration would not speak with me for this story, and Heritage says it could just be a coincidence that they don't know if they're actually following the blueprint. But according to my analysis, the Trump administration and other Republicans have called for more than half of the actionable goals in Project Esther, or they appear to have called for them at least. And so I think it's worth looking at the document in full to have an idea of what else we might see coming down the line.
You write in the piece, Project Esther's architects envisioned outcomes that at the time might have seemed far-fetched. Now, 4 months after Trump has taken office, Heritage Foundation leaders are taking an early victory lap.
Yeah, so again, they won't say for sure. And I, you know, if you recall last year, Project 2025 was so contentious. It became such a big talking point during the election campaign that Trump had to distance himself from it. So they're very careful to keep their distance from each other. But they do say that they meet regularly with officials from the administration. And Mr. Greenway said to me that it was no coincidence that we're seeing actions such as billions of dollars withheld to universities for federal funding. We're seeing calls to monitor the social media of immigrants for quote unquote anti-Semitic activity. We're seeing the, you know, attempts to deport people who have criticized Israel or argued for Palestinian rights. And so all of that is very clearly laid out in Project Esther.
And what Republican lawmakers are involved in formulating the objectives of Project Esther?
I think there's a really broad brush. You see people in the administration, Republicans in Congress. It's really hard to just pick one or two because it's really widespread.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. The response of Project Esther to your report? of the Heritage Foundation people behind it?
I haven't heard from them, but I think they're very explicit that this is what they're doing. They hadn't commented publicly before this, and I really had to bug them for a while to get them to comment. But this is all laid out online, and it has been for months.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll certainly link to your report in the New York Times. The report headlined, "The group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement." I want to thank Katie J.M. Baker, author of that article in the New York Times. As we wrap up this segment, we're going to turn to the final comments of Dr. Noor Abdullah. She spoke on Sunday night at the people's graduation for Columbia University. It was a gathering of hundreds of people allied with the students who were involved with protesting at Columbia University over the last year. Dr. Noor Abdullah, who is a dentist here in New York, gave birth to the couple's first child, Dean, last month. She held her child wearing a graduation cap that had a Palestinian flag on it as she accepted a diploma on her husband, Mahmoud Khalil's behalf. She addressed the crowd.
I'd like to end by reading a statement from Mahmoud that he wanted me to share with you all. Thank you for holding me in your hearts today. It has been 2 months since I was taken from my family and from you, detained simply for speaking the truth about Palestine. Columbia University, the place where we sought knowledge, justice, and truth, chose silence instead of solidarity. It failed me, but you didn't. You showed up. You reminded me that while institutions may abandon us, the people never will. Today, I want to say congratulations. You've made it through, perhaps not with degrees, but with your voices, your integrity, and your compassion intact. I'm endlessly proud to be among you, and I carry your love with me every day. Please keep carrying mine. And thank you all.
That was Dr. Noor Abdullah. At the end of the event, graduates lined up. They're actually graduating this week from various schools at Columbia University to receive their diplomas, and projected on the back of the stage, the church on the Upper West Side, was a diploma for Mahmoud Khalil, also for Dr. Noor Abdullah, and for their baby, who Mahmoud Khalil has never seen, for Dean Abdullah. When we come back, today would have been the 100th birthday of civil rights icon Malcolm X. We speak with his daughter, Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, about his legacy, and with civil rights attorney Ben Crump about the family's lawsuit to release all files about Malcolm X's assassination. Back in 30 seconds.
History's not made by presidents or popes or kings or queens or generals or CIA kingpins running dope. History's not made by nine-robed men or billionaires or bankers. It's not made by them.
Black Spartacus Heart Attack Machine by Tom Morello in our Democracy Now! Studio back in 2011. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 100 years ago today, on May 19th, 1925, the man who would become known as Malcolm X was born in Omaha, Nebraska. Malcolm X would go on to become one of the most influential political leaders of the 20th century before he was assassinated at the age of 39 on February 21st, 1965, as he was standing at the podium before a crowd in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom. His wife, Dr. Betty Shabazz, pregnant with twins and sitting next to her four daughters, aged 6, 4, 2, and 5 months, were in the ballroom looking on. In 2023, the family of Malcolm X filed a $100 million wrongful death lawsuit against the FBI, the CIA, New York City and state, and the NYPD, as well as the district attorney's office, for concealing evidence of their involvement in Malcolm X's assassination. Now his family is calling for President Trump to release more details about Malcolm X's assassination, just as he released thousands of unredacted files related to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and vowed in an executive order to release files on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The state of Nebraska officially designated May 19th as Malcolm X Day in 2024. His daughter, Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, was recently there to remember her father's legacy and joins us in our studio. But first, we go to an interview. In the 1960s, when Malcolm X briefly spoke about his childhood, he was questioned by Chicago reporter Jim Hurlbut in a clip featured in the PBS American Experience documentary Malcolm X, Make It Plain.
You were born in Omaha, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you left, your family left Omaha when you were, what, 1 year old?
I imagine about a year old.
And why did they leave Omaha?
Well, to my understanding, the Ku Klux Klan burned down one of their homes in Omaha.
They had a lot of Ku Klux Klan. This made your family feel very unhappy, I'm sure.
Well, insecure, if not unhappy.
So you must have a somewhat prejudiced point of view, a personally prejudiced point of view. In other words, you cannot look at this in a broad academic sort of way, really.
I think that's incorrect, because despite the fact that that happened in Omaha, and then when we moved to Lansing, Michigan, our home was burned down again. In fact, my father was killed by the Ku Klux Klan. And despite all of that, no one was more thoroughly integrated with whites than I. No one has lived more so in the society of whites than I.
So that was Malcolm X in the 1960s. Today would have been his 100th birthday. And today, the National Action Network will commemorate this birthday with Reverend Al Sharpton and national civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who joins us now remotely, and with members of his family, including Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters, professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice here in New York City, a community organizer, an activist, award-winning author of many books. Her memoir is titled Growing Up X, her most recent book for young adults, co-written with Tiffany Jackson, titled The Awakening of Malcolm X. Dr. Shabazz is the chairperson of the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Before we turn to Ben Crump, Dr. Shabazz, it's great to have you with us again. Your thoughts as you watch your father talking about growing, being born in Omaha, being forced out by the white supremacists there, his legacy?
You know, and as I shared with members in that community, that was a legacy, that was the foundation for my father. His parents instilled these specific values of love, of care, compassion, environmentalist. It's such a beautiful place. And it is just so indicative of how this young boy would grow up to be this iconic human rights figure.
Hmm. Well, I want to come back to that legacy, but Ben Crump, I know you have a court Zoom in a few minutes, and I want to make sure we get in this lawsuit that you filed and the demand that as President Trump releases most of the documents in the case of the JFK assassination and says he's going to do it in the case of the King assassination, you're in the family's demand that they release the Malcolm X assassination documents. What exactly you're calling for, and tell us about the lawsuit.
Certainly, Amy. First, I want to say thank you to Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz and her family for keeping the legacy of Malcolm X alive 60 years later on what would be his 100th birthday. We can never say thank you enough. As it relates to the court case and celebrating his enduring legacy, we continue to fight for justice for Malcolm X by any means necessary. We are calling for truth and transparency to finally be the prevailing factor in all of this legal minutia. We know that the FBI files exist. We know that they were surveilling every waking moment of Malcolm X's life. We know that they were aware of assassination attempts on Malcolm X before he was fatally killed in the Audubon Ballroom. And so in our lawsuit that we filed for $100 million against those who conspired to assassinate Malcolm X, one of the great thought leaders of the 20th century, we continue to try to make absolute certain to everybody who's paying attention that this was an intentional effort at the behest of the leaders of our government, that being New York Police Department, the FBI, the CIA, all the way to the very top. And so therefore, finally, 60 years later, on what would have been his 100th birthday, we implore the federal government to release all of the FBI papers on Malcolm X.
You know, as you sue the city, it makes me think about the fact the mayor is going to be with you. Is that right? Today at noon, Mayor Eric Adams, who is a former police officer, and now he's the mayor, and he has ability to release information about the assassination. Ben Crump, do you know if he's going to do this?
Well, you know, we are involved in litigation with the city of New York, and it is our hope that he is going to be able to speak with Dr. Shabazz, as well as other civil rights leaders who are encouraging him to help finally get justice for Malcolm X's family. You see, Amy, you know, 2.5 years ago, the city entered into a settlement agreement with those two brothers who were wrongfully convicted for killing Malcolm X. And when you really think about it, those men suffered. But who suffered the greatest for the assassination of Malcolm X? It's Malcolm's family, his wife Betty Shabazz, his daughters. That's who suffered the most. And can we finally give them some measure of justice and accountability? That is what this fight is for. In fighting to pay homage to Malcolm X's enduring legacy of self-expression and self-determination for Black people all over the world, as well as those oppressed by the oppressor and then exploited by the exploiter, what we want to do is make sure there is some measure of justice, some measure of accountability to Malcolm's family, to say that we understand that even though the assassin's bullet may have killed him, we never stop fighting for Malcolm X's life, for his justice, and for his accountability.
Well, Ben Crump, I want to thank you for being with us. Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, there'll be an event tonight at the Audubon Ballroom where your father was gunned down before your very eyes. How old were you at the time?
I wasn't quite 3 years old. But I have to tell you, in all the work that I do, I always think about my mother because she was a young woman. She had four little girls. She was pregnant with twins. Her home had been firebombed.
A week before.
And she saw 21 bullets ripped through my father's body on February 21st. She offered him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. She gave him the most comfort she possibly could. So I often think of how she safeguarded her husband's legacy and how she raised all six of her girls in this bubble of love. You know, in spite of all of the trauma, there was no despair, there was no bitterness that she showed to her children.
I wanted to go to your dad speaking a week before his assassination about the very firebombing you're talking about that almost killed you.
That's right.
My house was bombed. It was bombed by the Black Muslim movement upon the orders of Elijah Muhammad. Now, they had come around to, they had planned to do it from the front and the back so that I couldn't get out. They covered the front completely, the front door. Then they had come to the back, but instead of getting in directly in the back of the house and throwing it this way, they stood at a 45-degree angle and tossed it at the window, so it glanced and went onto the ground. And the fire hit the window, and it woke up my second oldest baby. But the fire burned on the outside of the house. But had that one gone through that window, it would have fallen on a 6-year-old girl, a 4-year-old girl, and a 2-year-old girl. And I'm going to tell you, if it had done it, I'd taken my rifle and gone after anybody in sight. I would not wait. And I say that because of this. The police know the criminal operation of the Black Muslim movement because they have thoroughly infiltrated it.
Because they've thoroughly infiltrated it, and this is the information you're trying to get right now. You were that 2-year-old that he was referring to along with your sisters.
Actually, that was, yes, that's right. That's right. That's right.
So this is 100 years later. You're keeping, to say the least, your father's legacy alive, along with so many around the world. And as you teach people at John Jay College, students, what do you think it's most important to understand about Malcolm X?
This sense of compassion. He introduced a human rights agenda to the civil rights movement. And so there are people all around the world who recognize every single individual's human rights. You know, he said, I tell you, there's just so many thoughts. But when I think of my father most, he was such a young man. You know, he was in his 20s when the world learned of him, 39 when he was assassinated.
He, like King, were assassinated when they were 39 years old.
That's right. They were assassinated both at 39. And he said, I don't know why I keep going on a blank, but this quote that is so important by introducing this human rights agenda to the civil rights movement for the first time.
We're talking to Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's 6 daughters. She's a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, as well as an activist. If you can talk about, you have the 2 men who are held in prison for decades. They've won tens of millions of dollars from New York City. They were exonerated. What would it mean for you to settle this lawsuit?
Well, you know, it's principle. And the quote that I was thinking of my father, he said, oh, gosh, every time I want to say it, so maybe I'm not supposed to say it, right?
Well, I bet you're going to say it tonight, and we're going to record it and play it on Democracy Now! In the coming days.
Okay. And, you know, one word that I can recall growing up with hearing from my mother is the word surveillance. Surveillance. And so I think of how traumatized, how my mother must have been traumatized at such a young age to experience and live through all of this, my father being such a young man, you know. And so we most definitely want to ensure that we get justice for our father. You know, he sacrificed his entire self. He said, we demand our human rights as your brother. There is no asking. We demand our human rights as ordained by God. And I would imagine it's the reason why there is this reverence for this young man whose legacy continues to inspire, empower, uplift people all around the world.
You're wearing all white today. Not black, to remember your father, the fact that he was assassinated, but white. Why?
Oh, you know, it's, you know, the spirituality. It's just a bunch of things. And I love my father. I love my mother so much. And, you know, whatever I can do to keep these legacies alive and thriving and, you know.
And tonight you'll be at the Audubon Ballroom, which your mother fought to save from destruction when Columbia was building its big biotech building. And there you have so many events honoring Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz.
And I want to say that my mother turned this place of tragedy into a place of triumph.
Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, on the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM radio. Burnaby.